Hello, folks. Welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast from the Labor Relations Information System. My name is Will Aitchison. I'll be your host for the next 45 minutes or an hour or so as we cover recent developments in the public safety workplace. Usually, I'll start these podcasts by talking about cases, maybe court decisions or arbitration decisions that involve firefighters or law enforcement officers, corrections officers somewhere around the country. I might even talk for a while about federal regulations or federal statutes, but today I want to begin by discussing a news story. And the news story is this constant drumbeat about recruitment and retention in law enforcement. And the reason that I'm prompted to talk about it today is within the last few weeks, we've had a huge report released about recruitment and retention, the first big nationwide study of recruitment and retention in law enforcement. Who released it? The Police Executive Research Forum did. I think of PERF, as it's called, as the big city police chief think tank. That may be a little bit unfair, but not grossly so. And it gives you a feel for their philosophies and sometimes their mission. PERF will study various issues from time to time, make recommendations as to policies. PERF, for example, has weighed in on use of force policies and body camera policies. Well, PERF became concerned about recruitment and retention, concerned about it very seriously towards the end of 2018. And in December of 2018, it gathered together a number of its members, 250 people in total, all told. Of the 250, 230 of them were police executives. The other 20 were officers and deputies. PERF followed up on that, and the topic was recruitment and retention. What PERF has now published is a report of its research. It's a long one. It's 72 pages long. We'll put a link to it on our website. And here's what PERF finds. First of all, PERF says we're in a crisis, we are in a situation where fewer people are applying to become law enforcement officers, and those who take the job aren't staying in the ways that they used to stay in careers in law enforcement. PERF says this is a feature of day-to-day life in law enforcement agencies all over the country. Law enforcement agencies, large, medium, and small, local, state, and federal, police departments, sheriff departments, state trooper agencies, correctional facilities. PERF says it's everywhere. And PERF says there are ominous signs that the workforce crisis in policing is getting worse. Why is it getting worse? It's getting worse really because of several reasons, says PERF. And I have a problem with one of them, but let me list them first, and then I'll tell you the one I have the problem with. PERF says, first of all, the traditional source of job applicants for law enforcement, the military, family members of current officers, that's diminishing. PERF also cites the economy and strong job growth, which create more options, higher paying options for applicants. PERF also cites the often rigid quasi-military organizational structure of most police agencies. That's PERF's words. That doesn't align with the preferences of job applicants. PERF cites all of those things. The one I have a problem with, by the way, is the job market. And the reason I have a problem with that is we've had stronger job markets in the past. We've had lower unemployment rates. We've had higher numbers of jobs in the past where we haven't had a recruitment and retention crisis in law enforcement. Something else I think is going on. I'm not saying the economy doesn't contribute to it. Of course it does. It does give people options, but I wouldn't list that as a top choice. And PERF doesn't list as a top choice what's really going on out there in the world. in terms of law enforcement applicants, many of them, who are looking at what the job of a modern police officer is and the stresses and the criticism that are often produced by that job. And those applicants are simply voting with their feet and saying, we just don't want to do that job anymore. PERF doesn't list that. And to me, that's kind of inexplicable that it doesn't. But back to PERF and what it does says. PERF says, look, this is a problem that's even worse because today we're raising the bar on what we expect from law enforcement officers. Policing has become much more complicated, says PERF. It requires officers to deal with all sorts of technologies, computers, body cameras, all those sorts of things that didn't exist before. And I'm going to quote here, today's police officers increasingly are being asked to deal with social problems, such as untreated mental illness, substance abuse, and homelessness. So we want more from our police officers today than we have ever wanted before. And PERF says the result is we are in a crisis. We are in a recruitment and retention crisis. PERF begins its study by saying law enforcement agencies are facing a triple threat. What's the triple threat? Number one, fewer people are applying to become police officers. Well, there's no question about that, right? There are some times where I have seen in the last 2 years the number of applicants for an open police position being lower than the number of openings. We never used to see that. And you see not just lower numbers of applicants, but lower numbers of qualified applicants. PERF points out that agencies, and I'm quoting, reported special challenges recruiting minority, female, and bilingual officers. And those are the types of people that, at least in many big cities, those are the primary targets of recruitment. And they are the ones who are most resisting being hired. So number one of the triple threat, fewer people applying to be police officers. Number two, more officers are leaving their departments, and in many cases, leaving policing as a profession entirely well before retirement age. This never used to happen, right? If someone became a police officer, the odds were so, so strong that you'd look up 25 years from now or 30 years from now or 20 years from now, depending upon your retirement statute, and that person would retire as a police officer. PERF points out that we are now finding a large number of voluntary resignations, people pursuing careers outside law enforcement. PERF thinks this is significant enough that it's one of the few things italicized in a 72-page report, and that the majority of these voluntary resignations are occurring within the first 5 years that officers are on a force. What's the third of the triple threats? We're about to see a bubble. The bubble's about to pop. Where'd the bubble come from? If you'll recall, way back in the 1990s under the Clinton administration, there was a huge push for hiring in law enforcement. A lot of federal funds were made available to local agencies, and police forces, law enforcement agencies grew around the country. Those people now have 25 years on the job. And we can assume that those people are going to quickly retire. PERF says their departures not only reduce the number of sworn personnel, but also the overall level of experience in many agencies. This triple threat, PERF says, occurs at a time when agencies are already short-staffed. It lists as the poster child here, the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, which is currently looking to fill 1,000 vacancies. And PERF concludes its overall observations by saying that between 2013 and 2016, the number of full-time officers in this country dropped by 3%, and that the number of officers per capita, number of officers per citizen, has dropped by 10% since 1997. Perf then gets into the body of the report, and it's followed by 12 conclusions. I do want to say just a couple of words about the body of the report. The Perf is very concerned about the fact that many agencies are lowering hiring standards. Their word is relaxing them, especially with respect to prior education levels, prior drug use, tattoos, and facial hair. Perf observes, I think quite correctly, that some of these changes may well be overdue because societal norms with respect to tattoos and facial hair have changed, and agencies have to adapt to that. But Perf, I think, also correctly points out that relaxing educational requirements and relaxing the standards for hiring about, for example, prior criminal records, that's very problematic. That's not a good idea. All right. What are Perf's 12 recommendations as to how law enforcement agencies can adapt to this recruitment and retention problem? Perf lists 12. I'm going to list the 12 for you. I'm not going to really comment on them very much. And then I'm going to tell you what number 13 should have been. Maybe should have been number one. And remember, when you hear these, what Perf is all about. This is a think tank for law enforcement executives with a distinct large jurisdiction bias. All right, so what are Perf's 12 recommendations? Number one, monitor your workforce demographics, Perf says. Stay ahead of current and future changes. And you need to figure out what types of staffing you need and adjust your recruitment and retention strategies accordingly. Number two, build trust in your communities. The policing profession has seen a period of dramatic, relentless change, Perf says, and you need to reach out to the community and rebuild trust in the community, because those sorts of relationships with the community will produce applicants. Third, seek recruits who are comfortable with 21st century policing and have the skills for it. This is Perf saying we need officers who are increasingly technological and officers who are capable of responding really as social workers as much as police officers. Number four, more training may be needed if your workforce's overall level of experience declines. This is Perf warning that, look, as that hiring bubble pops and you lose experience in your workforce, you need to beef up training. Number five, develop new strategies for recruiting officers with needed skills. Perf is really kind of vague on what exactly they're talking about here. There's really only one sentence. I'll read it to you. Updated methods include offering cadet programs and internships to encourage interest in policing at a younger age, forming partnerships with local colleges and universities, and relaxing requirements regarding previous disqualifiers, such as tattoos and past drug use. All right, number six, find new ways to recruit a diverse workforce. What are the new ways Perf is suggesting? Partnerships with religious organizations, organizations of minority groups, and women's groups may help recruit diverse workforces. Number seven, make sure that your recruiting messages reflect the reality of police work. So, for example, Perf kind of repeatedly focuses on this in its report. Stop with the SWAT videos. Those aren't attracting modern-day young people into policing. Instead, what you want to talk about is the service aspect of policing. Number eight, eliminate unnecessary delays in the job application process. Make sure that you are processing applications as fast as you can. And because, Perf says, we want technologically savvy police officers, make sure your web pages are up to date, because you may find your applicants are turned off by a, and I'm quoting, clumsy, illogical, or difficult to navigate web page for recruitment. Number nine, retention of officers is critically important. Use exit interviews to learn why officers leave your department. Number 10, offer employees professional development opportunities. Give them a chance to gain experience in other areas within an agency. Have like voluntary rotation policies that apply to different jobs, different assignments. Number 11, aim to meet employees' needs for work-life balance and wellness. What's PERF talking about here? They're saying agencies should consider more flexible scheduling systems and program wellness into the course of the day. And PERF acknowledges that in policing, flexible scheduling is a little bit difficult because you've got to have cops on the street at all times. But they're saying that we need to have a much more open mind with respect to scheduling. And then number 12, be willing to rethink old ways of doing things. So in other words, become more technological, become more open to change in how you respond to certain situations in a law enforcement environment. And that means, says PERF, think a lot more about greater civilianization in the workforce. So when I saw this list of 12 things, I was struck by them in a couple of ways. And the first way I was struck by this list of 12 things is by what wasn't on the list. You got to raise wages, right? That's at the heart of recruitment and retention. This is a labor market problem. And the way you deal with a shrinking labor market is not to stop with the SWAT videos, it's to raise wages. PERF is right. The job of a modern law enforcement officer is much more complex than it used to be. It's more complex, not just technologically, which PERF spends a lot of time on. It's much more complex because of simply the nature of the job that we have now, law enforcement officers around the country, as our first responders for mental health crises and drug overdoses, and if not drug overdoses, you know, very serious drug reactions. We are expecting officers to be social workers. We're expecting them to be mental health professionals. And we're expecting them to do all this with lower staffing. Yeah. The job is more complicated, and we want more from our law enforcement officers. We need to treat them like the professionals we expect them to be. And the way you treat a professional, in part, is you pay them well enough so that they want to do the job. It totally befuddles me that PERF didn't list compensation as number one by far, and its list of its other 12 items, would be kind of nice little twists that would help. But I was really struck by that. And the second thing I was struck by was the vagueness of many of these recommendations. You can see PERF struggling, and it's struggling because it's not coming right out and recognizing what's at the heart of the recruitment and retention problem. And that is this broad relationship between the community and law enforcement. That relationship needs to be healed. And until concrete steps are taken to heal that relationship, you are going to find young women and men simply not willing to do this job. Particularly in a good labor market, correct, but even in a bad labor market, even when we were in the heart of the Great Recession, we saw declines in the number of applicants of law enforcement officers. So it's an interesting report. I think it's got its problems. I would certainly recommend that anybody who is involved in law enforcement recruitment should be taking a look at it and taking a look at the recommendations, following up with the various agencies that are listed in the report as doing things that are creative. Definitely take a look at it. The PERF report hit my desk just a couple of days after a news article about law enforcement recruitment and retention in Nebraska. And this is actually, it's a really good article. And we will post this on our webpage as well. You'll be able to track it down. And the message in this article is, it's not just law enforcement. It's also state employment. And this, by the way, echoes a study that was done about a year ago that shows that almost all jobs in public employment today are seeing fewer applicants than they did 5 years ago and 10 years ago. Law enforcement's at the top of the list, but firefighters are on the list. Certainly corrections officers are on the list. But, you know, even truck drivers and teachers and, you know, you name it. There are less people interested in public employment today than there were 5 and 10 and 20 years ago. And this article focuses on the fact that that is true, in fact, in Nebraska. The article also cites the fact that where the shortage is most dire is with respect to 24-hour jobs. 24-hour jobs such as the Nebraska State Patrol and Nebraska Corrections. Not just those. There's, you know, 24-hour responsibilities at state veteran homes and youth rehabilitation centers and mental health facilities. But the article really focuses on Nebraska State Patrol and Corrections. And I was really taken by two numbers. With the figures in Nebraska. And the first is that the level of sworn officers in Nebraska State Patrol is at its lowest level since the 1990s. And that's because of an inability to hire. And secondly, there was this sentence in there about corrections that really stunned me. Okay, I'll just read it. And at Corrections, which has had the hardest time filling posts, overtime expenses are at a record level, and turnover of security posts, while slightly down from a year ago, is still about 30%, roughly twice of what is ideal. Ponder that for a moment. 30% turnover is twice what Nebraska Corrections thinks is, quote, ideal. Since when is a 15% turnover rate acceptable? Since when are we willing to tolerate the fact that we've got a situation on our hands where corrections officers who have just this impossibly difficult job, where corrections officers are losing 1 out of 7 of their compatriots every single year? How far we have come with respect to recruitment and retention. One thing on which I firmly agree with PERF, we're in crisis mode on this. Okay, on to cases. And I want to pick up where I left off with a corrections case. Since I'm talking about Nebraska corrections, I'm going to move on over and talk about New York corrections. And this is a case that illustrates a principle that we don't talk about all that often. And the principle is how far the law on sexual harassment, racial harassment has changed over the years. These changes certainly started with a series of 3 or 4 U.S. Supreme Court cases. These are, you know, the familiar 5-4 margin on the Supreme Court ruling in favor of an employer. And they have, the changes have just permeated through the lower federal courts. And I think we don't talk about these things out loud because they were uncomfortable with where the law is. But the law is quite clear, and it is virtually impossible for an employee today to bring a successful hostile work environment harassment claim. And here's why. Let me tell you first of all about the facts of this case, and then I'll get into the legal standard that leads to the result. And just a warning a little bit. I'm not a big one on trigger warnings, but I do want to warn you that some of the language here is going to be rough, and it's going to be rough because, and I'm going to repeat it, because I think you need to know the language in order to understand whether or not there is a colorable claim of harassment in this case. So what's going on? This is a case involving Kevin Perry, who worked as a corrections officer for the Westchester County Department of Corrections in New York. Perry was assigned to the booking unit, and another of our players, a guy named Captain Robert Slensby, was one of his supervisors. And all of this stuff happens in July of 2014. Perry completes a medical leave. He returns to work in the booking unit. And when he comes back to work, he's in the jail doing booking operations with Slensby. Slensby then places his hands on Perry's shoulders and begins massaging him. As Slensby did so, he said in a serious tone, here comes the trigger warning, if I was a female, I would fuck the shit out of you, and I would get a strap on and go for broke up your ass. Another officer who was present, Officer Mateo, smiled and stated, "What man says that to another man?" And in response to that, Perry tensed his shoulders and smirked. Perry claimed that after this incident, he suffered from all sorts of reactions, substantial sleeplessness due to nightmares of being raped by Captain Slensby. He ended up taking medications. He's called in sick for work, sought psychological treatment. Perry also claimed that the July incident made him more irritable, unable to satisfy his fiance because of his sexual dysfunction, and that he had high blood pressure and anxiety owing to Slensby's actions. Perry sues, and he sues both Slensby and the department, claiming sexual harassment, and the case is heard by a federal court. And the federal court dismisses the lawsuit, saying Perry has not stated a claim worthy of consideration by a jury. Why? Here's the legal standard, and the court is getting this legal standard correct. It is this is the legal standard the Supreme Court has given us. And what is it? I'm going to read a couple of sentences here. To prevail under Title VII on a hostile work environment theory, Perry must show that the workplace is permeated with disciplinary intimidation, ridicule, and insult that is sufficiently pervasive to alter the conditions of his employment. The standard has both subjective and objective components. Conduct complained of must be so severe that a reasonable person would find it hostile or abusive, and the victim must subjectively perceive the work environment to be abusive. So, why does Perry not state a claim here? And here's what the court says. There's no way a reasonable jury could find Slensby's actions and comments objectively hostile. The court comments that we have to consider the social context of Slensby's comments. And what does the court say? I'm going to go back to quoting. Perry himself testified to the work environment of the Department of Corrections by stating employees joked with each other, used vulgar and sexual language with each other, talked about sex with each other, and put their hands on each other. Even Officer Mateo testified to both Perry and Slensby laughing after the incidents. A trier of fact could not find Slensby's statements and shoulder massage to be severely hostile, particularly since such conduct was common in the Department of Corrections. Slensby's conduct is also not objectively hostile because the single incident was neither egregious nor frequent. Slensby only massaged Perry's shoulders once. Wow. Think about that for a moment. Let's consider the court's social context comments. And by the way, I'm not blaming this court or saying the judge got the case wrong. I mean, this is what the law is today. I'm just telling you what the law is. What does social context mean? It means that if there's enough harassment in the workplace that you can't complain of similar levels of harassment. If there's enough people who are making sexually laden comments or giving each other massages without being asked to give each to receive a massage, putting hands on people, if enough of that goes on, it's okay, at least as far as Title VII is concerned. That's pretty amazing, right? And even this instance where you have a laying on of hands, if you will, coupled with some pretty aggressive, sexually laden comments, that's not enough to be objectively hostile. The court doesn't get into the issue of whether or not Perry overreacted, and, you know, whether all these symptoms that he's reciting, sleeplessness, sexual dysfunction, blood pressure, all that, whether or not they're related to this incident. Court doesn't ever get there. It doesn't get there because it said what Slensby did not violate Title VII. And that's where the law is today. Now, does this mean that Slensby's conduct would not subject him to discipline? No, it doesn't mean that at all. Simply because conduct doesn't violate Title VII doesn't mean it's not punishable through the disciplinary process. The employer could easily have more stringent standards with respect to the behavior and the comments that Slensby exhibited here that could subject him to discipline. There's absolutely nothing inconsistent with Title VII for that. All this means is that someone who is the recipient of this sort of behavior doesn't have a lawsuit under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. Just a caution here to employers, though, I'll bet if you dust off your sexual and racial harassment policies, you're going to find that they directly quote from Title VII or reference Title VII. Just a reminder to you, as the law changes as to what Title VII means and what sexual harassment is, what a hostile work environment is, if you simply reference Title VII or use the words of Title VII in your rules, you're stuck with whatever those changes are. And under those circumstances, you might not even be able to discipline Slensby. So this is a reminder that you really want to take a look at those rules and make sure that the policies in those rules are the policies that you want to have. Next up, just a brief discussion. I'm going to get lawyery on you on this one and talk to you about an odd procedure in the courts. It's in the federal courts, and it's in most, if not all, state courts, known as remitter. All right. So what does a remitter mean, and what's this case all about? Well, this case is about a Pennsylvania State Police sergeant, a guy named David Holt. He filed a lawsuit against the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania and four of his supervisors, and he alleged multiple instances of race discrimination. He brought these claims under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, the Pennsylvania Human Relations Act, the Equal Protection Clause of the Federal Constitution, and also the First Amendment, Free Speech Clause. The court doesn't get into many facts about how he has a potential First Amendment case here. I'd be kind of curious. At any rate, a jury hears the case, comes back with a verdict, but the jury's verdict is a little bit flawed because it is what's known as a partial verdict. They didn't answer all of the questions that were extant in the case. So you have a second trial Holt wins on several of his claims, and he gets an award of $1.9 million from the jury. The state then moves after the jury's verdict, files a motion for what's known as judgment as a matter of law, meaning, all right, the jury's decided the issue, but legally there's an insufficient basis for the jury's decision. And the judge actually grants the motion for judgment as a matter of law on all but one of the claims. So there's one claim left, and we don't know exactly what the claim is. And then the state files a motion for a remitter. What is a remitter? And a remitter is where a judge says to the plaintiff in the case, and the judge awarded a remitter here, the judge says to a successful plaintiff in the case, Holt here, who's got $1.9 million, he thinks. The judge says, I think that verdict is excessive or wrong or for whatever reason. And you, plaintiff, you got a choice. You can either take X, whatever the amount of money is that is X, or I'll give you another trial. And X, in this case, says the judge, is $50,000. So instead of $1.9 million, you'll get $50,000, or you can take a new trial. Holt takes a new trial, goes to a different jury. The jury gave him $2,700. So we're now down from $1.9 million to $2,700. And Holt appeals, and it goes up to the Federal Third Circuit Court of Appeals, which upholds what happened. And here's what the court says. Two sentences, I think, are key in the court's opinion. A jury verdict may be overturned on the basis that it is against the weight of evidence only when the record shows that the jury's verdict resulted in a miscarriage of justice. Cries out to be overturned or shocks the conscience. While Holt is disappointed with the jury's award, perhaps even personally shocked, the record fails to establish there was a miscarriage of justice, nor does it cry out for the verdict to be overturned. And the court cites the fact that the jury is in the best position to assess things like Holt's mental anguish, his pain and suffering. They got to hear him testify, whatever his monetary loss was. And the court says there were facts on both sides of all those issues. So the jury could indeed end up with $2,700 as the right amount. So here we have, through the remitter that is sandwiched in the middle, we have a $1.9 million verdict that is eventually reduced to $2,700. And this is a common feature in federal court jury trials. You will see a jury come back with award, and usually the employer is going to file a motion for a remitter. Courts sometimes give them, sometimes don't give them. But I'll tell you what, if you scratch 100 people who have nothing to do with the legal system, they'd be shocked at the notion that such a vehicle actually exists, that a court could actually say, I think you may have gotten too much money here. Here's your choice, new trial or this lesser amount, whatever it may be. And that's what happened to David Holt. I want to wind up this podcast talking about a major Brady case that just came to us out of the California Supreme Court. Just as a reminder, a Brady case or a Brady list today all starts with the Supreme Court's decision in the 1960s in Brady versus Maryland. And in Brady, the Supreme Court held that the prosecution in a criminal case has an obligation to disclose to the defendant information that is relevant to the case. It's a discovery obligation. obligation that the prosecution has in criminal cases. And it's thought to be part of due process for the prosecution to turn that information over. In the years since, in the half century actually, since Brady was decided, the rule has gradually been expanded by lower federal courts and state courts to include material that may be in the file of a law enforcement officer. It might be in an internal affairs file, might be in the form of an entry in a personnel file. And if that information that is in the file is of potential use for impeachment purposes, most prominently, if the information in the file reflects dishonesty, prior dishonesty on the part of the law enforcement officers, these lower federal courts and state courts have held that that is Brady material that has to be turned over to the defense. And when it gets turned over to the defense, it's usually, not usually, it's always under the auspices of a protective order that prohibits the defense from otherwise releasing the information. There are some guarantees about confidentiality of the information. Well, the U.S. Supreme Court itself has never ruled whether Brady extends to law enforcement personnel and internal affairs files, but nonetheless, it's a pretty well-established principle, as I said, at the lower federal court and state court level. So what's the case about from California, and what does it do? Well, California has a number of statutes that are referred to collectively as Pitches statutes. Pitches is a former sheriff in Los Angeles County, and what the Pitches statutes do is to establish a procedure under which someone who is a litigant in court, could be a criminal defendant, could be in a civil case, a litigant in court can obtain confidential materials out of a law enforcement officer's files. So it's kind of the same sort of thing as Brady, only it's a very set procedure. And what the Pitches statutes mandate is that a motion be filed and the court consider whether or not these are confidential records and make the usual range of decisions about whether the records need to be turned over. Do they need to be turned over? Do they need to be redacted? What sort of protective order needs to be in place? That sort of thing. What goes on in this case, the Supreme Court decided just recently in California, is a decision by the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department to create its own Brady list. And that's a list for whom disclosures, list of deputies for whom disclosures would have to be made. Usually Brady lists are created by prosecutors, and so this is somewhat different. And the sheriff's department decides it's going to create its own list. It populates it with the names of roughly 300 deputies out of the 7,800 deputies working for the sheriff's department. And it announces its intent to disclose that list to the prosecution, to the Los Angeles County District Attorney's Office. The union that represents deputy sheriffs, the Association for Los Angeles Deputy Sheriffs, ALADS, objects to that, files a lawsuit, and the California Court of Appeals rules that the sheriff's department would be violating the Pitches statutes by turning over this homegrown Brady list to the prosecution. And the California Supreme Court rejects that argument, but rejects it somewhat narrowly. So what is the Supreme Court saying in this case? The court says, and I'm going to read you four or five sentences, more than I normally read you from these opinions, because I think the court's words are really important here. The court says, we conclude that the department may provide prosecutors with the Brady alerts, kind of the list sort of notion, at issue here without violating confidentiality. There can be no serious doubt that confidential personnel records may contain Brady material. An officer may provide important testimony in a criminal prosecution. Confidential personnel records may cast doubt on that officer's veracity. Such records can constitute material impeachment evidence. Because confidential records, the court says, may contain Brady material, construing the Pitches statutes to permit Brady alerts best harmonizes Brady and Pitches. Brady imposes on prosecutors an obligation to obtain favorable evidence that's known to others acting on the government's behalf. They're considered to be constructively aware of Brady material. And the court says, in this context, construing the Pitches statutes to cut off the flow of information from law enforcement personnel to prosecutors would be an anathema to Brady compliance. So what's the bottom line in this court's opinion? The court is saying, because the way it kind of focuses on this whole notion of Brady alerts, it is saying that in particular cases where a deputy sheriff is likely to be a witness in a case, there is nothing wrong with the sheriff's department telling the prosecutor, hey, this deputy has potential Brady material in his or her file. So it is not a broad-scale disclosure requirement. It's not you have to turn over the list of all 300 people. It is a particularized Brady alert in individual cases. And the court is saying, secondly, that that can be done without the Pitches motion process, without the intervention of a trial court and the hearing and considerations of relevance and confidentiality and everything like that. The court is essentially saying that whole process, whether or not this gets turned over to the defense eventually, that's part of the Brady process. That's not necessary. We don't need to have Pitches motions before a law enforcement employer can, on its own, identify one of its employees to the prosecutor as an employee for whom there is potential Brady material. Hard-fought case, and as I mentioned, the Supreme Court here overturns a contrary court of appeals opinion. Since then, just kind of at the local political level, the sheriff who created this whole idea of Brady alerts has been defeated for re-election. A new sheriff who looks kind of askance at this whole process has taken office. It'll be interesting to see where this whole issue goes in the future in Los Angeles County. Well, that's it. That's First Thursday for October 2019. We're firmly in fall weather here in Portland, Oregon. The rains have started and the cool air has joined us. It's bracing. It's wonderful. We actually welcome it here. We hope you join us. We've at our next LRIS seminar. This is one on advanced police discipline that we will be holding in November in Las Vegas. And also, we hope you consider joining us. You'll be getting a mailing on this shortly if you're on our mailing list. We're doing our first ever wellness seminar in spring of 2020. We're doing this in Nashville, and we have brought together wellness experts from public safety agency, police, fire, corrections, from all over the country to talk about what I think of now is increasingly one of the most important problems in the public safety workplace, and that of employee wellness. So with that, this is Will Aitchison signing off. We'll see you next month.